for tuning in once again to Our Living Hope, the Bible teaching ministry of the Ocean View Christian Reformed Church in Norfolk, Virginia. I'm your host, Teresa Myers, and I'm so glad you decided to join us for this broadcast. This morning, our pastor and Bible teacher, Reverend Gary Roost, will continue his study series on the book of Job. Those of you who have heard the previous messages in this series will recall that Pastor Roost considers the book of Job to be a book of comfort and encouragement for Christians in our time. Now, why should the story of a man's deprivation and intense personal suffering be a story of comfort and hope? Because, as Reverend Roost has already pointed out, it is a story that reveals to us how God upholds Job through the Spirit of Christ so that victory is ultimately assured. In permitting Satan to test Job's true motivation for serving God, we learn what our own motivation for service should be. Pastor Roos put the question this way: do we love the giver or do we love the gifts? Satan argues that Job loved only the gifts, but God was confident that Job loved God, the giver. All people fall in one category or the other. Even Christians, as they serve God because it pays to do so, are in reality not much different from pagans who worship their gods for the same reason. In today's message, Reverend Roost will show us from the scriptures what are the first evidences of Job's true devotion to God as Job responds to the news of financial disaster and the horrible loss of his sons and daughters. What is it in Job's response to his losses that reveals his genuine godly character? Let's find out as Pastor Roost leads us in this important lesson that is so applicable to our own lives today. May God bless you as you listen.
For the benefit of those of you who may not have heard the previous lessons on the book of Job, we're going to again read part of the scripture that we have discussed already in the first chapter of the book of Job. And we're going to read then from chapter 1, beginning with verse 6, and reading to the end of the chapter, verse 22. So let's turn to the book of Job once again, chapter 1, beginning with verse 6. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the works of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to his face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but do not lay a finger on the man himself." And then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "Fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. And then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away, may the name of the Lord be praised. And in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. And thus far, the reading of God's Word, may He add His blessing on His Word as we consider these words this morning. The first point we want to consider this morning deals with the substance of Satan's accusation against Job, and implicitly against God also. Satan argues that Job's righteous service to God is real enough, but it is motivated by love of self rather than love of God. And God, in turn, is implicated because He plays along with this relationship by paying Job very handsomely for his service to God. In other words, that's how God gets people to do what He wants them to do. Now, psychologists refer to this kind of manipulation as respondent conditioning, and it is often used as a means of getting people to change their negative behavior by rewarding in some way a good and positive behavior. Now, parents too often find that they have to promise a reward, don't they? They promise a reward to their children to get them to clean up their room or to do their homework. It is indeed the mark of a mature person who does something because simply it's the right thing to do, and to do it for the benefit of others without consideration for himself. Now, Satan asserts here in our text that as soon as God stops blessing Job with material prosperity, Job's true character will reveal itself. So you see, both Job and God are implicated in Satan's accusation. And, as we have said before, this accusation gets to the very heart of God's integrity in creating mankind in His own image. If man's image is flawed, doesn't that imply that God's image is flawed as well? This is indeed a very serious charge, and God does not let it go unchallenged. The trouble is there a man, even one, who can prove Satan wrong? When we look at mankind all around, aren't you and I sometimes tempted to think that Satan is right after all? This is what Job's suffering is all about. Is there a man with a true heart? Now, in making this accusation, Satan is also making a statement about the nature of God's goodness, about God's own character. He implies that God does not, and indeed cannot, give gifts to mankind simply as a manifestation of God's love for His creatures and His desire to bless them. Satan is saying that God really has no choice but to reward desirable behavior and to punish undesirable ones. In a sense, God is a victim of the very laws He's created. He is not seen as being totally free to act outside of the universe that He has created. He's part of it. He has to play along with the rules. God and man are both locked into a universe where cause and effect are absolute. So neither God or man is free to act in accordance with their own will. To put it in another way, and to put it very simply, selfless love, according to Satan, is an illusion. Love is an illusion in such a mechanical world. Now, such a fundamental charge against God's character cannot go unanswered. And it is the purpose of the book of Job to demonstrate that both God and Job are free to act in accordance with their true nature. And that nature is genuine love. Love one for another without ulterior and self-centered motives. But can Job stand the test? And that is what we will consider in this message this morning. As we consider the theme, the first evidence of Christ's work in Job. And I call it the first evidence because there are, in fact, two tests. As you know, if you've read the book of Job, there is this first test in which he loses all of his material possessions and his family. But as God had warned Satan or limited him and said, you can touch all of these material things, but don't lay a hand on himself. Then in the second test, God even takes that away and Satan is allowed to touch Job's body and inflict him with grievous diseases. So here is the first evidence then, and Lord willing, we will look at the second evidence at a later time. And you notice I call that the first evidence of Christ's work in Job. I didn't call it the first evidence of Job's great success or the first evidence of how Job lucked out. and pick the lucky number. No, Job succeeds here against Satan's accusation because, as we have said, it is Christ's work of renewal that is already at work in Job. Creation has fallen. Job is part of that fallen world. But God, from the very outset, began a new work of creation in Christ. And all those who believe in God and in the promises of deliverance through a son have that new work beginning in their hearts. And what God begins, God completes. And that is the only reason that Job succeeds. It is because of what God is doing in Job. Now, I want you very briefly to understand that the historical context is, I think, rather important. Because the story of the book of Job takes place long before there's a nation of Israel, long before there are temples and priests, long before there's the law of Moses. So that the criteria for Job being a righteous man has nothing to do with what the Jews would ordinarily consider makes a righteous man. Because, as you remember, the Apostle Paul, before his conversion, believed that his righteousness was based entirely on keeping the law of Moses. And he believed he had done so perfectly. He kept the Sabbath, he did the tithing, he did the washing, he did the ablutions, he participated in the festivals, he observed the right holidays and the right times and the right seasons, right according to the book. He observed all the dietary laws, he had done all of those things. But Job is not encumbered by any of those because they do not yet exist. Job's life takes place somewhere in the age of the patriarchs, as we will learn from his friends are in fact descendants of Abraham's children by his wife, second wife, Keturah. So it takes place totally outside of those ordinary criteria by which we would say, here's a righteous man, because he keeps the Sabbath, because he keeps the dietary laws. Job is a righteous man even in the eyes of this pagan world long before the nation of Israel and the law of Moses has been formed. So Job's righteousness was not determined by canon law, but by his life and by the actions that were demonstrated in his walk with his family, in his community, and in his service. And so we have spoken here of the evidence of God's work in Job, but we want to also note, first of all, there is evidence of Job's righteousness. And that evidence of his righteousness is shown in two things, the proper use of Job's wealth and a consistent life of worship and intercession. Now, we learned that in the very first part of the book before we even went over to heaven and learned the accusations that Satan was giving. Now, you say, where do we know all of that? Well, we know all of that from the dialogues that follow and from Job's own autobiography about the good days when he had wealth and power and strength. And from that we learn that Job was indeed a great leader who used his wealth as influence for good. Job was in fact a city councilman. He was a leader who sat at the gate, which means that he was part of the ruling authority of that society in which he lived. And we know that as long as Job was on the council and that Job was in charge, wicked people kept their distance. They were afraid of Job. They didn't like Job, but they feared him because they knew that as long as Job was on the job, their evil scheming would not get too far. Job was also very generous to the poor. Yes, he was blessed. You read the list of the property that he owned. That was not in the hundreds, but in the thousands of cattle and camel and sheep and goats. But Job's relationship to his wealth is as important as the wealth itself. You see, Job had already learned something that Paul had learned much later on, as he writes in the book of Philippians. He says, I have learned the secret of being content in all circumstances. I have learned how to be content when things are going great, and I know how to be content when things aren't so great. I have learned the secret of contentment, whether in much or in few. Well, Job had learned the contentment of much. And that is no small thing. Job's relationship to his wealth was a healthy one. It wasn't for self-aggrandizement. It was for the blessing of the society in which he lived. His children gave him power. As when you have many children, you can face your enemy on an equal footing and you can bargain with them. Why? Because you've got power behind you. You've got your seven kids who are going to be there after you are, who are going to see that things get done right. And in a time when your children were your greatest asset, you can imagine the tremendous loss that Job had suffered. But while Job had all of these children, while he had this wealth, he had the influence and the power to do what is right in his society, and that is what he did. And that is why the wicked people feared him and cowered before him, and he kept them in check. And that's why it was a great place to be, if you were going to be poor at all, to be living where Job was living, because he would be sure to take care of you. Job was gracious and generous to the poor. He pleaded the cause of those who were oppressed. Job was on the side of the down and outers. Job's judgments could not be bought. And that's why this tragedy of loss is not merely a loss for Job. It is a loss for the whole community. As we learn later, those teenage kids, those young little shenanigans that were kept in check, now start taunting Job. And now all of these guys are coming out of the woodwork and say, hey, Job's out of the way. Now we can do our thing. So the loss of his wealth was not merely in terms of numbers or gallons or in any quantity, but it was a disaster for their society. We also see evidence of Job's righteousness in that he was consistent in his life of worship and intercession. So this is something that is very often overlooked in the book of Job, because we look at his gracious character in time of deprivation when he has lost it all. And that's certainly true. But Job knows more than anything that the greatest risk of cursing God is not in poverty, but in wealth. And that is why he was concerned for his children, that at their birthdays, when they invited the whole family together and the wine flowed freely, these parties, you know, didn't go for just an hour or two, but for days on end, that Job thought that perhaps in the celebration of their collective wealth, that they might in fact curse God. Oh, not to his face, but to begin to think that it was their wisdom and their own power that had brought them this. And so Job, after every one of these parties, called all of his kids together and he sanctified them, that he's probably went through some ritual washing to set them apart for God. And he gave sacrifices, lest they perhaps in their hearts had forgotten that God is the giver of all of those great gifts. And you see, it is these two things of how Job related to life when he was wealthy that enables him to be the same kind of person when it's all taken away. Job is not hooked on his goods. Job seeks the giver of the gifts rather than the gifts itself. And Job knows, as he says in those famous words, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away, that all of life is a gift of God. And he has absolute and sovereign right over it. Our problem very often when things go bad and don't go our way, or we are bereft of things, is that somehow we had a right to these things and we cry out, why? But Job understands that God is the giver. That Job lives out of grace. I was reminded again once of a story I heard recently, and just the other day again, I thought it fitted in here. No doubt a concocted story, but there's a story about a fellow who had his portrait taken at a photographer. And when the pictures came back, he was furious. He went back to the photography shop and he threw the pictures down on the counter before the photographer. He says, you know, these photos don't do me justice. And the photographer said, sir, with a face like yours, you don't need justice, you need mercy. Yes, Job wasn't seeking justice because he knew what his face was really like. He lived out of the grace of God. You see, God was a welcome guest in his home. Not just when things go bad and we call upon the name of the Lord, but Job lived out his life in the joy of the gifts that God gave. And it is that why he could also live graciously in the absence of those gifts. Job knew that having God, the giver, was far more important than all that God could give. But now we look then very briefly at those evidences of God's work in Job. And that is seen, the victory that God that works in Job is seen, first of all, in the grief over his children, the mourning process that he goes through. You remember he tears his clothes, he puts ashes on his head, which is the typical Mideastern form for mourning. And secondly, we see it in his praise of God. So first of all, we recognize that Job here is not some sort of stoic, some hard-hearted person who says, well, easy come, easy go. He doesn't say to his wife, well, we've lost all the things, but hey, we've still got our health. You know, we can start over. Yeah, we've
you know, we've had to declare chapter 13, you know, we're bankrupt, but hey, we're going to buckle down and, you know, we're going to just go on ahead. And you know stories, you know, rags to riches. Guys that make millions, lost them, had millions again, and so on. Just pick up where you're going. No, Job genuinely grieves because the loss of his beloved children was great. And it was only after Job heard, of course, that his children were lost. This was the greatest deprivation because it basically meant that his family and his clan had no future and no strength against any oppressors in the future. Those many arrows in his quiver, so to speak, were broken. And he would not be able to face the enemy at the gates on an equal footing, strength to strength. So Job mourns the loss of his children. He is not some hard-hearted stoic who says, well, life just goes that way sometimes. No false optimism about the future, but in all of his grief, he turns to God and says, I came into the world with nothing, and I know I'm going to leave the world exactly the same way. It's the Lord who gives. It's the Lord has taken away. Notice he doesn't say, Satan did it. No, the Lord took it away. Is that really true? Wasn't it Satan the one who took it away? Well, no, we can say the Lord indeed did take it away. The Lord gave Satan permission, but he also set limits, did he not? And that's something we must never forget. God always sets limits on how he allows Satan to test us in our lives. As Paul says, it's never beyond our strength to endure. With the temptation, God gives a way of escape so that we may be able to endure it. Job knew that. And in the stories, the reports of all of the disasters, you remember that two of them were as a result of human violence, marauding bands. But two of them were acts of God. One tornado swept through the house, knocked it down on all the kids. They died. And another one was fire from God, it says, fell down upon the sheep and killed them, burned them up. Man, you can just imagine people saying, God must really be angry with Job. Look what he's done to them. Acts of God. But Job sees another perspective. God gave, and God has every right to withhold. Regardless, may the name of the Lord be praised. May the name of Jehovah be great in the earth. May he still be seen as the loving, gracious God who gives to all generously and without reproach. Job did not call on his death. This is what Satan expected. Satan expected that Job was essentially a hireling, that he was a mercenary. You know what a mercenary is. It's a soldier who works for a country that's not his own and fights battles that are not his own. He's strictly in it for the money. And they're willing to even risk their lives on dangerous missions, but they're only doing because they're getting paid, probably big time. But we call that a mercenary. They're not doing it out of love for country, out of patriotic passion. It's the money. Job is a mercenary. He does all of these wonderful things, which are not denied. Job does the righteous. He protects the poor. He keeps wickedness in check. He uses his power for good, and it's a blessing to the community. But Satan says the only reason he does that is because you bless him. You pay him off. And you take those things away, and he's going to take you to court. He's going to demand his wages, just like if you have done a week's work and your boss says, well, I'm not paying you this month. You know, you either quit or take him to court or both. Why? You've got a right to do so. But Job understands that his relationship to God is not that of an employer, an employee. It's not that of a mercenary to a country that's paying him to do a nasty job. Job understands that God is giver and that he is a child of God. That in a great loss, Job is and remains in a right relationship with God. And he is able to praise the name of the Lord, not only in his wealth, but also in a time of deprivation, pain, and loss. And I'll conclude at this point by saying there's only one way that you can really explain this. Is that the spirit of sonship, that ability to see what Job saw regarding his possessions and even his family, as a gift of God, can only come from a regenerate heart, from a work begun by God through Jesus Christ in the heart of every true believer. You see, Job, we learn a great truth, that it's not that Job is perfect, but he's for real. If you remember last time I talked to you about that illustration about that crumpled, torn, taped up and tattered dollar bill, that one of those Coke machines probably will reject. You know, it's so crumpled up and so torn up. But you can take it to the bank and you can get four quarters. Or you can get it exchanged for a brand new crisp bill. Why? Because it has the same value as any other bill. It's genuine. It's for real. no matter what it looks like. Job here is in tatters. He's dog-eared. He's torn. He's got tape. He's got marks from tellers scratched all over it. But he's still the real dollar because God has made him that. That's the work that Christ has begun, even in Job, even in that time, without the law, without the temple, without the priests, without all of those mandated sacrifices. Job worshiped God from the heart, not because it paid to do so, but because he was a son. The book of Job is meant to be, I believe, above all, a book of encouragement for us. It's not simply to say, oh, well, if Job can do it, so can you. No, Job can't do it. The point is, if Christ can do it, so can you. And Christ has done it. Christ went through a whole lot more guff than Job ever did, and was deprived of a whole lot more that he had a right to because of his perfection. And he gave it up for you and me. That same Spirit working in Job is working in you and in me. And that's why we too will succeed. Not only in the first evidence, but in every evidence of our lives.
We trust that you found Pastor Ruth's exposition of Job's first trial to be a help to you in understanding the nature of that trial and how Job withstood in faith despite of the awful calamities that befell on him. In his worship, Job confesses that he is a creature formed from the dust of the earth. He came from dust, and he will return to dust. He has brought nothing into this world. In saying this, Job expressed his total dependence on God for all things necessary for life. Job acknowledges that it is the Lord alone who gives all things, and he has every right to withhold them or take them away. Job's worship of God is derived from God's own character and being, rather than on his provisions. Job sought God's presence, not his presence. That, dear friends, marks the difference between a genuine saint and a merely religious person. If you have any questions about your relationship to God, or if you have a special need or request, Pastor Roos will be happy to speak with you. He can be reached by phone at 588-2077, or you can write us at 1241 Hillside Avenue, Norfolk, Virginia, 23503. If you are new in the area or have no other church home, you are most certainly welcome to join us for worship each Sunday morning at 11 o'clock a.m. and 6 o'clock p.m. We are located at the corner of Hillside Avenue and Beachview Avenue, just one block south of East Ocean View Avenue. You can also visit us on our website at www.oceanviewcrc.org to learn more about us and also listen to our other broadcasts. Please write or email us with any comments, questions, or prayer requests. Our phone number once again is 588-2077. And our website is www.oceanviewcrc.org. For now, this is Teresa Myers saying goodbye until next week. May God encourage you this week through His Spirit.